I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. I'm Stephen Atwell. With me is Eric Loomis. Hello, Eric.
Howdy.
And Sean McElwee. How are you doing?
Hey, doing great.
So the reason why I've convened all of you today is that all of a sudden this topic, which when I started my dissertation research was very much a dead language, is all of a sudden in very much in the media. In fact, as we were setting up, I just saw a new article pop up on New York Magazine by Eric Levitz, suggesting that moderate Democrats should run on the idea of a jobs guarantee, which for those of us who have studied the history of jobs guarantee sounds like kind of the world turned upside down. So I thought, you know, this would be a good opportunity to talk about jobs policy, the history of it, why it's come back to the present. And I thought I'd sort of start with just the very basic question for those of our audience who don't know this particular jargony corner of the world. Sean, what is a jobs guarantee and how does it work?
Sure. There's actually quite a bit of debate about that. the proposal that we look at specifically in the piece is a new proposal that Derek Hamilton and Sandra Darity wrote about in a CBPP, Center on Budget and Policy Priorities paper. It's not a policy that has been officially endorsed by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, but what they would essentially create is a national infrastructure and jobs investment bank, and they would have communities come up with ideas for potential jobs and submit those job applications to the bank, and then the bank would then give communities money to sort of make those jobs a reality. That's one proposal. You could imagine why a Democratic Party might be sort of worried about that level of local control, and there would be another policy proposal that might come up. There's a lot of discussion about using this for explicitly progressive aims, things like green jobs, creating green infrastructure. And there is also proposals for things like taking on what's called monopsony power. So in a monopoly, you have one seller and lots of buyers. And economists are increasingly worried that you have the reverse in the labor market, which is one buyer and lots of sellers. So you could imagine a place where Walmart is the sole major employer of labor. And that gives Walmart a lot of power to drive down costs. So people are thinking about this in the healthcare industry as well. And there's been talk about having more sort of guaranteed jobs doing things like care work. At the other end of the spectrum, you have people who just really like the idea of more public employment. So you can imagine, you know, we've lost about 1 million public sector jobs since the height of the Great Recession, and we could sort of invest in bringing those back. But to the sort of central question you've asked, the idea is still getting onto the agenda in a real way. And I think that we're starting to see think tanks begin wrestling with what it would actually look like. And I think that progressives would be correct at this point to be sort of agnostic as to what the ideal policy framework is going to look like until we actually see, you know, more senators endorsing this policy, more think tanks thinking serious about this policy, and starting to actually get legislative language written up.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very good point about the senators, because one of the things that sort of flashed to my mind is that I've been sort of loosely affiliated for a while with the National Jobs for All Coalition, which has been sort of pushing this kind of policy for, you know, many decades now. And, you know, I've often or not, in, you know, in recent years, I've sort of been, you know, a little bit worried about, you know, does this policy have any traction? Because, you know, some of the Congress people who've been, you know, carrying these bills for a long time are starting to retire for various reasons. And, you know, so it was sort of surprising in some ways to see it come up all of a sudden. And one question that I sort of want to throw out to both you and Eric is, why do you think that jobs guarantees are gaining traction now when unemployment is relatively low, as opposed to in like 2007, 2008? You know, because we didn't see job guarantees being seriously discussed, you know, when Obama was preparing his stimulus bill, outside of, you know, some sort of cursory mentions of the WPA from folks like Paul Krugman. Do you think it's just that the Democratic Party is shifting left in all areas of policy after 2016, or is there some particular gap that jobs guarantees fill?
Well, I think there's a combination of things going on here. I mean, one, I think, yes. I mean, the loss of Hillary Clinton and Trump's victory, you know, sure, that cleared space for, you know, the left to sort of discredit a lot of centrist ideas that deserved discrediting a long time ago. And but I also think that this is – I think there's a number of other things happening here. I mean, I think the difference in part between now and 10 years ago is that, you know, I think of the left really going back to the 80s. After the and I want to talk a little bit more later about some of the policy ideas of the 60s and 70s that we can revive as part of a broader national progressive program. But I think that with those defeats in under Carter and then under Reagan and the blowout in 84 and Bush in 88, you know, again, it really threw the left on its heels on and not only in terms of electoral politics, but in terms of a lot of policy areas. And so you might have, you know, some of the older Congress people that you're talking about around, you know, who may have been pushing those ideas in 1980 and are kind of retiring today. But really, I think on the for younger people on the left, fresh ideas coming out around a lot of economic issues for really a very, very long time. And I think it's part of the reason why the left was so on its heels really through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, through things like NAFTA, through the, you know, through the WTO and all of this. And you said these sort of moments of protest, but not really long-term programmatic thinking. And I think the left has really changed on that in recent years. And I think that you, what you're starting to see right now is that a left increasingly smart about politics and increasingly wonky and serious about its policy proposals is really starting to figure out that the Democratic Party can be taken over fairly easily in a relatively short amount of time using smart policy proposals and doing the work to make that happen. And so whether you're talking about criminal justice reform, you're talking about the minimum wage, you're talking about free college education, or in this case, you know, this sudden rise of a federal job guarantee, I think this is a sign of where the left is going and where the Democratic Party is going, because centrist Democrats don't have very good answers for any of these questions right now.
Yeah, I would think of it as sort of three broad buckets for why the guaranteed jobs is coming up. And I'd love to let Eric sort of speak more to the history. But the history is really interesting here in the sense that, like, this is an issue that unions have pushed on for a long time that has had decent amounts of credibility within, like, sort of broadly progressive circles for a long time. It's something that the American National Election Studies has polled on every election for as long as it's been around. It's just been weirdly, like, outside of, like, the sort of event horizon of politics. And I think three main things push in. First is you have a lot of increase in sort of broad public support for government that really didn't exist at the time of the 2007 financial crisis and the reaction to it. People are now sort of hungry for a government playing a larger role in their lives. The second, and this is really key, is the rise within the left of the importance of full employment and the discrediting of ideas in the center about the sort of natural rate of unemployment. There was a sort of belief that was held even by Obama's economists that if you started to get down to 4 or 5% unemployment, you would start to unleash basically like uncontrollable inflation. I think that that policy consensus has been destroyed. No one is really worried about inflation. And so a guaranteed jobs now is something that doesn't seem to have as big of a downside, even among the elites. And the last, and I think it's something we really try to hit on our piece, is progressives realizing that the geography of public opinion and public support for their policies really matters. So you can actually see this in the Center for American Progress, Roy Tuchera's piece, where he says we need to win over like white working class people, and we need to think about policies that will like successfully do that. And what our work at Data for Progress shows is that the Guaranteed Jobs actually has pretty consistent support across a broad range of geographies. And my guess is that the Center for Market Progress is sort of seeing similar things with their analysis, and that this is a policy that, you know, people who are really worried about what we saw in 2016, which was Democrats winning the popular vote but losing because of geography, are increasingly open to ideas that have like support in urban and rural zip codes. So those are the three things that I think are really pushing this on to the front of the agenda.
If I could follow up on one thing you said, Sean, I think one thing we're going to look back on and see is really critical here is the passage of the generation who grew up in the inflation crisis of the 70s. You know, that this sort of overreaction to what was admittedly a very big problem in the 70s. But in any case, I think we're moving past this inflationary period or this period of a freak out about inflation. And I think that's part of the reason why there's such room to open up to new economic ideas right now.
Mm. So I wanted to your talk has brought up two new questions to me, which is one of the things, you know, as someone who's studied the history of this that kind of interests me is the divergence or the relationship between public opinion and elite opinion. Sean, I think you're quite right that job guarantees are quite popular broadly geographically. They're also very popular across time that, you know, you look at, you know, very conservative periods of American history, right? The 1950s when, you know, I Like Ike and, you know, anti-communism are sweeping the country. Or you look at the 1980s, right? The era of Reagan. And, you know, it barely budges the needle. It's like still 67, 70% of the country, you know, saying that job guarantees are a good thing and a way to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of what I tried to write about in my book is to explain, like, why is it that a popular policy not only is just not passed into law, but is, you know, put into the margins of political discourse. So partly, you know, what I'm wondering about, maybe Eric is right about this sort of it's a passage of generations of elites that, you know, elites who were there for the Humphrey Hawkins Act in 1978 or, you know, who generationally reacted to the election of Reagan is, you know, and thinking that, OK, you know, any progressive policy is doomed. Maybe the situation is that they've passed on and that we've got a new generation of political elites who are more welcoming to this. Although the fact that, you know, Bernie Sanders also lived through all of this, I think complicates the generational story a little bit. The other question I had, and this is, you know, when I saw the Center for American Progress's version of a job guarantee is it possible that the center is moving? That it's not just that, you know, we've got more progressives coming into the Democratic Party in the wake of 2016 in the same way that they did in the wake of Howard Dean and Obama. But that, you know, the sort of the central ground is having to move left as sort of like a belated, you know, asymmetric polarization going on.
Yeah, I would say two things. The first, to your point on the generation of elites, I really strongly agree with that point. And like most, you know, sort of young people who are thinking about these policies have just been like tearing my hair out as to like why elites within the Democratic Party are so sort of terrified of these ideas. And it actually really helped me to sort of like go back and read like Thomas Edsel's, you know, Chain Reaction and really read at the time just how sort of like devastated the intellectual left and like the Democratic Party perceived themselves to be in that time. And how much that they felt like they couldn't get out of this ditch, and everything they did to like spin the tires like did not work to get them out of this ditch. And look, I still think it's like wild that people like Mark Penn write op-eds in the New York Times saying like we need to move to the center. But I do have a sort of understanding of like why a lot of the sort of elites in the party feel this way, if even though they're, I think, dead wrong. On the elite opinion stuff, one thing I like go back to a lot is Social Security cuts. There is no policy that I know of with like durable public policy support lower than cutting Social Security. I can say honestly, like, it is less popular than things like abolishing ICE or like capping prison sentences at 33 years. It's a wildly unpopular idea. 1 in 10 voters around would support like Social Security cuts, but it is constantly at the top of the agenda because of very durable support in elite circles. And I think we just have to get away from this idea that like what is on the agenda is in any way correlated with what the public wants. And it's really a game of sort of like, what are elites willing to tolerate?
Well, and then this is why I think that this idea of, you know, taking the Democratic Party over from within, I think is critical, because, you know, so long as Democratic Party politics are ceded to these elites, nothing positive is going to happen on these fronts for exactly the reasons that you're stating. But as we're seeing, if you begin to force them to move due to the people that are being elected, it begins to make a difference in a relatively quick manner.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the thing that was very noticeable was, you know, the election in the Pennsylvania 18th, where the sort of post-election spin was very much that Connor Lamb was a moderate Democrat. And I don't think they're wrong about that necessarily, but the definition of what a moderate Democrat is seems to have changed, right? That this guy is vocally pro-union, he's pro-Affordable Care Act, you know, he's against cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Like, that's not what a Blue Dog Democrat would have been even in 2009. So that suggests to me that, like, maybe the center has shifted a little bit, you know, in response to pressure, but maybe also in response to a sort of growing understanding that like the electorate maybe can take something a little bit more radical, maybe is interested in something a bit more radical.
It's like, look at Doug Jones. Look, he has a pretty centrist voting record in the Senate, but he is certainly, I mean, probably at the median Democrat in 2006, you know, prior to the sort of wave. Like this, you know, we really have shifted what it means to be a moderate Democrat pretty definitively. And it's really worth noting that before Doug Jones won that election, everyone assured us that you could not be pro-choice and win an election in Alabama. And then, you know, Doug Jones was pro-choice and won an election. They said, okay, well, it's because, you know, Roy Moore. And then, you know, Connor Lamb won his election. And what's going to happen in 2018 is we're going to see a lot of candidates who are pro-choice who win elections that we were always told could not be won by pro-choice candidates. And I think that you're going to start seeing that with more and more things like guaranteed jobs. And I would say that another priority for the progressive left in sort of this taking over the Democratic Party is getting these senators and maybe House members who want to run for president to be forced to stake out increasingly left positions. There's really no reason, from my perspective, why Espiot, for an example, in New York, who has a 0% chance of ever losing an election to a Republican and basically 0% chance of ever losing a primary election, why cannot he say, you know, yes, we should have guaranteed jobs. Yes, we should defund ICE. You know, any sort of left position from them. It's very odd to me that we are seeing so much sort of like hatred towards Manchin, and I get it. Manchin is awful. Why aren't we sort of pushing the Carolyn Maloney's of this world, the Espiots of this world, to stake out like definitively left positions? Because you see on the opposite side of the Republican Party, safe Republicans, there's basically no limit to how far right they are willing to go. And there's no reason to me that a left, you know, House member can't go further left than they are right now.
So I want to move for a few minutes away from the realm of politics and more in the realm of sort of ideas and high-minded philosophy. So one of the other sort of popular, newly popular ideas out on the left, and not only on the left, is the idea of a guaranteed minimum income or a universal basic income. And, in part because of the stuff that I came across in my research and in part because of my own political interests, I wanted to know, like, do you think, and this is for either of you, that job guarantees and guaranteed minimum incomes are complementary or competing ideas? And I think what this gets to is, like, what is the end goal for progressives? What is the sort of the good society that we want to look, you know, that we want to have? Is it fully automated luxury space communism, or is it, you know, 0% unemployment, or 1%, or 3%? Is that, you know, U3 or U6? Which is the sort of narrower or broader definitions of unemployment for our audience who are not policy geeks like me.
Well, I have to say that I mean, I think that the two goals are complementary, but I think that they're taking up different spaces on the left, right? That you know, and I think this leads to the other reason and potentially why you're starting to see greater support for universal job guarantee, which is automation. Right, that although unemployment is relatively low right now, the projections for automated unemployment are really quite high, and so I think that you're starting to see people worried about that, and that's kind of led to some of this universal basic income conversation. I think that a guaranteed jobs program is in fact universal basic income at its most politically palatable. I feel like there's in a lot of the conversation on the left about universal basic income, it tends to come from, I find, a lot of sort of really highly educated lefties who are sort of dreaming about a post-work world and how great that would be. And that's all fine and good. But I also feel like that the role of work in American culture is really high. That the most successful parts of the American welfare state are connected directly to a lifetime of work, i.e. Social Security and Medicare. And those parts of the welfare state that are less connected to work are often much more politically vulnerable. Because we've all heard these, you know, discussions of, you know, women on welfare, welfare cheats, people cheating disability, and it's not, and it is racialized, but it's not strictly racialized. And you know, people will talk in contempt of their own family members who are trying to cheat disability or these sorts of things. And I think that work, you know, the Horatio Alger myth. Yes, Horatio Alger was in fact a pedophile, but nonetheless, his work ethic ideas are very central to American life. And especially with the way that young boys are taught about a job well done and supporting your family, and that may reinforce patriarchy, but nonetheless, those are very real parts of American culture that are not going to go away. And I think that turning universal basic income into federally guaranteed employment reinforces ideas about value in America rather than simply sort of hand waves them away in hope for some, you know, right, you know, fully automated space communism. So that's part of the reason why I'm such a strong supporter of a universal jobs program.
Yeah, the way that I think about this is that they are complementary and actually should be seen as sort of addressing different social scourges. Like, we have two great scourges from my perspective in the American economy. The first is involuntary unemployment, people who want to work who cannot find work or who cannot find work at a sort of like suitable income. And the second is the scourge of poverty among folks who cannot have jobs. That is mostly the children, the elderly, folks with disabilities, who make up the vast majority of the poor. The working poor are people we talk about a lot, and we should address working poverty. But the non-working poor are also a large share of it. And I think that the guaranteed jobs is a way you solve this involuntary unemployment. And I think a sort of basic income is the way you solve poverty among folks who cannot work. And I really worry about the idea of a universal basic income solving automation, because I think that we want a policy that solves involuntary unemployment to solve involuntary unemployment. And we want a direct cash transfer to solve poverty. And I think that there's an idea that these can't go together, but I look to Moon Jae-in, who's the current president of South Korea. His first big policy initiative was creating about 800,000 public sector jobs, which in an equivalent country population size, so that would be 7 million jobs in the United States. So really, really large number of jobs. At the same time as directing an increased cash transfer to families with children, and at the same time as he increased the minimum wage. And I think that that is a really smart way to do this, which is you have this scourge of working poverty, you increase the minimum wage. You have the scourge of involuntary unemployment, you create a guaranteed jobs program. You have the scourge of poverty among families with children and child poverty, direct cash transfer to those families. And I think we too often try to like have one policy that we just load up with different stuff on top of it. And what we should actually do is really clearly articulate what the problem we're trying to solve is, and then the policy mechanism to solve that problem. That's my great guaranteed jobs v. UBI take.
Right. I mean, I just want to say that I completely agree with this. I think that, you know, greater cash transfers, for instance, in the, you know, to families and things like this are great. I guess where I'm concerned about it is where you start seeing people, you know, talk about, you know, working out universal basic income that would also include, you know, getting rid of Medicare or getting rid of, you know, aid to families with dependent children and sort of replacing the already very limited welfare state we have as opposed to supplementing that. And that's where I really draw the line.
Yeah, and I think it's noticeable that you often hear those variants of UBIs coming out of Silicon Valley, where, you know, the sort of automation is not something a social cause to be avoided. It is, you know, a desire most most consummately to be wished. I have to admit, my thinking on this has changed in recent years. I used to be very hostile to the idea of a guaranteed minimum income because I thought that job guarantees are more politically palatable, and they are. I also thought that, you know, there's certain economic concerns about inflation and about, you know, productivity, about the sort of the value of labor that is lost when people are allowed to be unemployed. But, you know, in recent years, one of the things I've actually been thinking about in terms of a UBI is the sort of, I guess, the inflexibility of a lot of our systems for people who, you know, who don't work or who aren't currently working. So, for example, you know, this summer I became disabled, and when I asked about, like, hey, is it possible for me to get disability benefits for a few months before I can start working again, they said it's going to take a year and you're going to be denied first time because they automatically deny anybody, you know, who's like under, I think, 50. And I also, another friend of mine who happens to be disabled, just got like his Medicare revoked because he was deemed too able to work. And this strikes me as sort of an insane system, that we have a system which makes it extremely difficult for people to get help. When they do get help, is very surveillant to make sure that they can't possibly work. When I think if you sort of asked, you know, attitudinally among the American public, would you support a cash transfer program that would help families or, you know, families with kids, you know, get childcare so that they can work, or a cash transfer system to help disabled people be able to support themselves? So, you know, in the UK, for example, there is, or at least used to be until the Tories got their hands on it, a system of what were called, I think they were called like independence allowances. And they were things that would help people, you know, give them enough of the sort of services and income to allow them to be independent in the rest of their life, and sort of seeing rather a very harsh binary between, you know, independent, not independent, working, not working, more of a spectrum where, you know, okay, someone might need a care aide to help them, I don't know, make meals because they've got arthritis, but that they can do this other job. And, you know, or someone else might need, you know, money for transportation because they can't drive, or, you know, and they need a bus pass, and, you know, or, you know, they can work, but maybe they can only work part time because that's all that their health allows them to do. So we need to make up the rest of that income.
Yeah, just on the disability point, the sort of Republican push to gut Social Security disability insurance and the way that centrist pundits and elites played along with it is one of the most despicable things that we've seen in the last 2 years. But to your broader point, yeah, we have a program like TANF. We have programs like SSDI. And what we should be doing as progressives is, when we get power over like governor's mansions, we should make TANF like more directly going towards poor folks and make it easier to access. And we get control of the presidency in Congress, we should expand those programs and make eligibility easier. And I think that one of the problems with this like grand guaranteed jobs v. UBI is that it misses that we have programs that look a lot like a universal basic income, and we could easily have programs that look a lot like a jobs guarantee. And we should begin expanding both of those and pushing the horizons of both of those at the same time and expanding those already existing programs. I mean, it's not hard to imagine a Democratic governor basically taking the TANF money that they get from the federal government and saying this is going to be all direct cash transfers to poor families immediately. We're not going to do any more bullshit bureaucracy. We're not going to do any, you know, aid to crisis pregnancy centers. This is direct cash transfers to poor folks. That's not at all hard to do, and it should be something that's on the policy agenda.
Mm. So I have – I'm noticing that we're at the 30-minute mark, so I don't want to push us too long. But I do have sort of two last sort of conceptual questions that I wanted to throw out there. One of which is, you know, how are job guarantees different from workfare? And like, you know, how does it make us rethink the way that we think about work and, you know, whether that comes from the public or the private? And then the final thing that I want to ask about is, you know, there was this famous paper by an economist, Mikhail Kalecki, who said that full employment was a threat to capitalists. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether that is still true, or whether the sort of increasing drive by capitalists to casualize labor, to shift labor from whenever possible, from employees to outside contractors, to this sort of increasingly dominant minimum staffing model where, you know, you have as few workers on hand as, you know, you can get away with to staff, you know, whether it's a Starbucks or a CVS or whatever, whether that's sort of changing the potential response from business.
Sure. I think full employment is absolutely still a threat to the capitalist class. And I fully expect that if a guaranteed jobs program was on the agenda, we would see pretty fierce pushback from them. To the broader question of sort of is this workfare, when I sort of talk to policymakers for the piece to try to get them to sort of go on the record in support of this, that was something I heard pretty frequently. And I think that it's something that should really be considered pretty deeply in policy design. The reason that I like the idea of a jobs guarantee broadly is, though, that it really gives the democracy and the sort of public some ability to define what is meaningful work to be done, rather than leaving the definition of meaningful work to be left to markets, which have done a bad job. So the example I tend to use for this is like we have a massive, you know, Texas-sized pile of trash in the ocean. That is a lot of work. Capitalism does not consider it to be a job. And if we could create a sort of like a mechanism by which the public sector could define the idea that like cleaning up that trash is meaningful work and it should be paid well and it should be a job that people can do, that is the sort of idealized version of this. And I think that that does differ from the sort of work fair as just like job for job's sake vision of labor.
Yeah, I mean, that does kind of remind me a little bit of in California, a program that I've come to admire a lot, which is in-home supportive care. In-home supportive services, where senior citizens and disabled people who get care in their own homes as opposed to in a home get a budget essentially for their care that they can decide how to use. And what I thought was really interesting about it is the people who get paid for doing this care work become unionized public sector contractors. They're organized through the Domestic Workers Union. United Domestic Workers. Whether they are like professional carers or whether they're family members, mm-hmm. You know, providing care. And I've always thought that there's something potentially really interesting, a way to sort of, you know, because the United States doesn't have family allowances and, right. You know, we shredded AFDC, a way to sort of, you know, as you said, right, rethink the definition of socially valued work as a way to sort of legitimize and protect social benefits.
Yeah. One thing I do want to note, I wasn't trying to dodge your question about the sort of like how has employment changed and sort of been contracted out. I just, from the people that I've talked to, sort of the sources I have, like who work close to unions and are really interested in having this on the Democratic agenda, their sort of like universal opinion was that if this was on the agenda, it was something that corporations would 100% push back on. I thought your point was very interesting. I'm just speaking to like what I've heard from the sort of folks who are close to the politics of this. And the last thing I would note is I think a really interesting part of this is going to be watching Republicans say that jobs are bad now. And I think that, like, you know, it's really going to be interesting for Democrats to actually be able to put Republicans in a tough spot on an issue like jobs. And I would really encourage Democrats to try it out.
Yeah, I have to admit I was being a little bit provocative. I think it's more of one of those things in which, you know, it should be – employers should see that it's in their long-term interest. But, you know, outside of the rare Edward Filenes of the world, I think most of them will sort of go to full opposition. So I wanted to leave the last word here to Eric, who's been very patient. So Eric, what do you think about the capacity of jobs programs to sort of change that cultural meaning of work that you were talking about earlier?
Well, I mean, I think that a successful jobs program, you know, I mean, I think it does a few things, right? It reinforces, to a certain extent, it reinforces that culture of work, but it also can redefine work. I mean, I think that part of the conversation we're having here that is really part of the broader national conversation around economic issues is what is meaningful work, right? Is it just, you know, guys in steel mills, or is it people who are teaching guitar to kids? Is it home care workers? And I think we're moving toward that latter definition. And I think that a federally guaranteed jobs program both, you know, reinforces that shift, rethinking what valuable work is while also still placing a high value on work itself. And moreover, you know, as part of this conversation, I mean, if you go back to the, you know, we didn't really get a chance to get into the original Humphrey Hawkins Act, which was the 1978 full employment bill that by the time was passed was utterly eviscerated by the Carter administration. And there's complicated reasons around that. But I think that one of the points that's worth thinking about from that bill or its original versions is that it not all of this job creation has to be direct government employment. There are a number of ways that private sector employment can also be stimulated that will help program along, and that can also make a difference in selling the program. It makes a difference in, you know, the overall tax impact of that program. And so whatever that looks like, I think that when we're thinking about a federal jobs program now, we need to be really flexible. We need to be thinking very broadly. People, as these early studies are doing, will start narrowing down and start, you know, figuring out the impacts of this or that. But I think being really broad right now is important. And I also want to just close by saying that simply getting a very high possibility Democratic presidential candidate in 2020 to say that she supports a federally guaranteed jobs program is an enormous victory for the left. That, and I think that is going to have that kind of thing, which we're going to see more and more of, is going to start having a broader impact on those moderate senators in the party who are going to, supposedly moderate, who are going to start finding themselves left behind.
Well, I have to admit that part of the reason I didn't go so much into detail on Humphrey Hawkins in our talk is that I want to leave something for my forthcoming book, which covers the Humphrey Hawkins Act in some detail. So I want to wrap things up. I'll just, you know, throw out to first to Eric and then to Sean. If you have anything that you'd like to plug before we close up here, Eric, anything that you want to plug to our listeners?
You know, my new book, History of American 10 Strikes, is coming out in October from the New Press. So if you want a history of America through class conflict that avoids the kind of cliches that the left sometimes pushes and really gets down into the details about why unions have been successful and why they haven't been successful, you know, you could always try to buy it when it comes out.
Okay. And Sean, do you have anything that you'd like to plug?
Absolutely. So I run a new newsletter that's a weekly newsletter where I cover sort of the Democratic primaries and the stuff that I've been writing. And that's Patreon/S McAwee. And I'm also the co-founder of a new organization called Data for Progress, dataforprogress.org. And we're really going to be using sort of like public opinion and studying the geography of public opinion. And also we're working on a new model to find out who the shittiest Democrats are. So that'll be coming out soon.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank our listeners for sticking with us as we are still experimenting with this newfangled audio technology. And have a nice day. Bye.